Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11am here on BCFM 93.2. This week, former newspaper editor Nick Outerside on the Regional Press. And John Redman from SAFE, that's Standards Against Female Exploitation. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Nick Outerside. We heard from him last week about some nasty stuff he had to deal with in his past, and he's just brought out a book called The Hill, Songs and Poems of Darkness and Light. But this week, he talks to me about the Regional Press.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined on the line now by Nick Outerside, who's a former newspaper editor. And he's also the author of a book called The Hill, Songs and Poems of Darkness and Light. But Nick, I'm going to talk to you this week about your role as a newspaper editor. First of all, how did you get into it in the first place?
Oh, I got into it through the back door. Initially, I was writing columns for glossy magazines, and then was given a staff job at a magazine stable in Manchester. And our news editor was a former newspaper hack, and this is 1988, roughly. And I wanted to get into newspapers, and he warned me against it. He said, "Don't do that, Nick." He said, it's much more fun here, you know, writing to monthly deadlines. But I did, and I applied for my first job in newspapers in 1990 in North Wales. And it then sort of snowballed from there, and I stayed in the profession until last year.
Going back to the glossy mags, what sort of articles were you writing? How did you find the sort of subject matter that they liked?
The very, very early days of computers. I was into adventure gaming, and listeners may remember BBC Micro User. That was the first magazine I worked for. And this is the old BBC Bees, and I was adventure gaming and writing in solutions to adventure games initially to a columnist who then gave me things to review. Then suddenly a vacancy came up on another magazine in the stable. And then finally, I think it was 1985 or 86, I was offered a staff job as assistant editor of what was then called Atari ST User. And I stayed in that role until 1989.
So 40 years or so of doing this. How have you seen things change in the publishing world?
I think primarily in the newspaper industry, the heyday was almost certainly the 1980s. Advertising revenue was at its peak. The Nationals had multi-hundred thousand circulation on a daily basis. And it went right through into the 90s. And I remember two of the papers I worked for, the Scotsman in Edinburgh and the Herald in Glasgow, both had daily circulations of 100,000. We were well-staffed, we could pursue stories with vigour, and if we needed to put manpower at something, we could. And it was a good time. We certainly could put our eyes on investigating various matters, and we could actually put together very good newspapers. And looking back now, the ones I particularly remember, the times, the Dunblane massacre in 96. I mean, some of the papers that came out of Scotland at that time were just untouchable. And even when I moved south in 1998 to the Sunday Sun in Newcastle, we still have a circulation there of 100,000 every Sunday. And, there were good times for people had their news in one way only, and that was through newspapers.
What about some of the investigations that you were doing? Were you not rubbing up against the great and the good, the rich and the powerful? And I wonder, were they pushing back?
Yes, we were. And yes, they were. Some of the stuff we did was like the old Sunday Times Insight team. We were really sort of digging into things. They didn't like it, but it cut both ways. One is we did not have the internet then, so we didn't have the ease of looking into certain matters that we would have now. But equally, they also didn't have necessarily the way to kick back at us as they wished. I mean, I came across a number of investigations where when we touched too deeply, there were certainly dirty tricks at play. I mean, one I remember, the Dunblane massacre, was looking into Hamilton's links with Freemasons and with certain named police officers. And all of a sudden, the Lord Advocate, who's the chief law officer in Scotland, called all the Scottish editors in and warned them that any further investigation would be seen as sub judice and would be treated as contempt of court. So they certainly used your hammer to crack a nut. But we also had our phones tapped. They didn't like it. But on the whole, the principal regional newspapers then were independently owned or owned by small companies. And at the time, we were able to pursue matters, pursue investigations pretty well as we wished. And we did uncover some cracking stuff along the way.
What did it teach you about the way power really works?
Initially, it taught me that I think that the earliest investigation I remember doing was in 1990-92, and this was the deselection of a Tory MP, a now deceased lovely man, even though I'm not a Tory myself, called Bill Hodgson. And it was done by dirty tricks at the highest level, of the Scottish Conservative Party. It involved people like Lord Willie Whitelaw. It involved the then Duke of Argyll, and it involved Tory Central Office. And when I saw sort of those dirty tricks at play, I thought to myself, this is, you know, how old was I then? I was in my 30s. I thought, this can't really be happening. Of course, it was. It was really happening. A few years later, we're looking into a pretty murky history of the Doonray nuclear processing plant in the north of Scotland, the experimental plant in the north of Scotland. And some things that happened in 1965, 66, which we had enough evidence to publish would have led to a Chernobyl-type meltdown at the plant and how they disposed of the hot rods. And we had a break-in one night where evidence from our lockers was stolen. The police were unwilling to investigate it. They didn't even want to investigate it. We had the director of the Atomic Energy Authority visit us personally to lobby us not to look into this anymore. And at that point, you're looking and thinking, crikey, there are things they do not want us to report.
I know a couple of articles of yours, which I've read from years gone by, Nick. One is about the Aurora jet that was apparently using Macrihanish Air Base on the west coast of Scotland, which is rather a special base, being, I think I'm right in saying, the longest runway in the whole of Scotland. And also, the runway goes right out to sea, so it's quite easy at night time to bring jet aircraft in there from the sea that nobody is going to actually be able to identify, spot it or whatever. So tell us a bit about that, the Aurora jet. Do you think it really existed or not?
Well, I'm pretty certain it did. I mean, after all, they denied the stealth bomber existed long after it was in service. I lived very close to Macrihanish for 2 years, and not only is it the longest airfield, I think actually in Europe, or Western Europe at the time, but also it adjoins, at the time, an American nuclear submarine base. Which has now been decommissioned. And my former father-in-law, who'd lived there all of his life, said, well, for years we saw these huge trucks go by with rubble. He said, rubble and building materials. And he said, as they're building this airstrip longer and longer, he said. The people I spoke to, Bill Sweetman is one guy, a number of other people who are experts in this field, convinced me that, yes, the Aurora certainly did exist, and it was being test flown regularly across the North Atlantic.
Does make you wonder, doesn't it, if there's actually quite a lot of technology out there that the military deny exists, that you know, that they're actually maybe even decades ahead of what they admit to.
I'm not an expert in that field, but I'll nod my head to that one, definitely.
The other story was about the Bilderberg conference that happened up in Turnberry, and I followed the Bilderberg for many years and found it very interesting that the organization was set up in the mid-1950s, 10 years after the end of World War II, with the chairman for the first 20 years was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was actually started his career as a Nazi and an SS officer in Germany before the war. And the idea that this is a very big, powerful organisation that meets behind the scenes, out of the media spotlight as much as possible, rather concerned me. I wonder what you found at the Turnberry 1998 Bilderberg meeting, Nick.
I think it was my dealings with it was actually a year later. What struck me was 98 was at Turnberry, a colleague of mine was arrested just for being at the Turnberry Hotel and was kept in police cells, I believe, for 48 or could it even have been 72 hours without charge. He had no idea why he's being held there. He was working at the time for a national paper, and they did not want him around.
Nick, but what was he arrested for?
I don't remember. It was something minor. It was criminal trespass or something like that. But he shouldn't have been where he was, and for no other reason. But he wasn't charged. He was just held to stop him reporting anything that was going on. But it struck me that anyone who is anything, certainly in politics in Western Europe, has had to have been to a Bilderberg conference. I mean, the list of former prime ministers and ministers in this country, pretty well all of them, from Blair to Kenneth Clark, have been attendees at these things. I was interested the following year when it was being held in Sintra in Portugal, where we had certain information leaking out. And we tried to report on this prior to the conference taking place. And some pretty heavy tactics were used. I don't know by whom. I can only guess. But to stop us reporting the facts, so much so that a report I had due to be published the following morning was changed overnight, with pressure being put on the deputy editor by unknown people from London.
So how does that sort of thing work? How can someone from outside actually determine or maybe change and edit what's going to be published in a newspaper? One would have liked to think that the newspaper editor has the final say, but it seems to, from what you're saying, that maybe sometimes that's not the case.
Yeah, I mean, a newspaper editor is always answerable to a publishing director or an editorial director above him or her. And there are huge, huge financial pressures put to bear on that particular newspaper group. They had a lot of links with very big business in Scotland. I've seen it happen on a much lesser scale over the years since then as well. This is the part of the whole demise of British newspapers. It's all down to the bottom line.
What about the regional press then? Because we've seen quite a lot of newspapers in the southwest here simply fold, not even turn into an online version of itself. What's going on?
Again, I said a moment ago, it's advertising pressures on the bottom line. It's due to many, many factors which have conspired together. Primarily, it's new technology. People, particularly youngsters, but anyone can get their news from so many different platforms now. And newspapers have become less attractive for advertisers. Advertising revenue has gone through the floor, and with it, circulation in newspapers. I mean, two of my old papers, The Scotsman, when I was there in the mid-90s, were 100,000 a day. I'm not going to sort of defame The Scotsman now, but I believe their circulation is about 30,000 now. That's a third of what it was. It's true of all papers, and it's gradually wedging down onto the very small newspapers. Your little weeklies, which would have had a circulation maybe of 7,000 or 8,000, are now seeing their circulation around 4,000. And when it gets to that, it then becomes economically not viable for the publishers to keep the organs going.
Yes, but we've got newspapers like Metro, the Evening Standard in London, which have been distributed for free.
Yeah, it's the cash cow. They're bringing it in because of the advertising revenue they can attract. If they can turn round to the advertisers and say, listen, we're reaching 2 million households every day, they will get the advertising revenue they need. And that is the bottom line. And the one thing you will see these newspapers, the percentage of pages which are filled with advertising rather than news is much greater than it was. I mean, in the old days, we'd always say 60% news to 40% advertising. It's now almost certainly true to be the other way, in some cases 70% advertising to 30% news.
But almost impossible for anyone new to break into that market.
Yeah, if anyone ever wants to. I think that the future is very different now. I think we're looking at online newspapers, possibly looking at micro local newspapers, probably a paper for a town maybe. Where I live here in Shropshire, we have a town paper which is succeeding incredibly well because the people who live in the town can only get their news for the town from that one paper. But if you live in a wider area, for instance, like Bristol or Somerset, I mean, you can get your news from so many different platforms.
Have you got any tips for anyone who's thinking of getting into journalism, young people today? Is it certainly not going to be as easy as it was in the 1970s for you?
No, it isn't. I think if they're starting out, they need to skill themselves in as many different avenues of journalism as they can. But certainly most young people leaving university or leaving school even now, you know, have their smartphones with them, their iPhones. They have a tablet. They have maybe a desktop at home as well. That is the future. All broadcast media, radio and TV. I don't like to second guess what will happen in 10 years' time, but I think newspapers have reached the end of their natural lives.
Finally, as someone who's spent their life doing journalism and also spent a lot of that time doing news, where do you get your news? Where would you think is a good news source? Because there are all sorts of different grades, aren't there? I think for a lot of people, Rupert Murdoch's whole stable of television stations and newspapers are not the best place to go to find stuff which is going to be in the public interest. Where do you get your news from?
A variety of sources. I think you're quite right. I mean, you've got to always look behind the scenes. If you've got a large publisher like Rupert Murdoch, you've got to work at what's the agenda? You know, I would not go to Sky News or even in the States to Fox News or CNN for my news. I look around. I think the problem is, and probably younger people may be probably more on the ball than I am on this, is check out your sources. Check out where it's coming from. There's so much spin. I mean, I'm looking currently in the last 6 months at the situation in Palestine and Israel. I mean, the entire so-called publishing spin has been to portray Israel as the good guys and these Arabs from Palestine that need to be got rid of. And even yesterday, there was a story on the BBC along that vein. Where you do drill down and look at the local sources. You see the reverse is completely true. It's We've always been fed propaganda. Even in the First World War, we were fed propaganda of how horrible the Germans were. On this Day of Remembrance, you need to look around and check out your sources and check out what you're reading. Don't believe everything Wikipedia tells you, and don't believe everything that Sky News tell you.
But I'm going to try and pin you down here, Nick. If you had to grab one daily newspaper today to have a look at, to get a bite of what's going on in the world, which one would it be?
Probably only because I know the editor well, and I know he's a good man, it would be the Guardian.
Okay, Nick Outerside, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Pleasure.
That was Nick Outerside, regional press editor and author now of a book of poems called The Hill, Songs and Poems of Darkness and Light. Now, over to Angela Balassi.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Hello, I'm joined by John Redman from Standards Against Female Exploitation. John is a former police officer who set up a charity, SAFE, 2 years ago to tackle human trafficking and underage working in the sex industry. The charity has saved several women from a life of exploitation and works to raise greater awareness in the sex industry. Hello, John.
Hi, Angela.
Could you tell me, I mean, human trafficking is quite a widespread issue. Do you think that the public are aware of it?
Well, it's really kind of the most underreported problem that I think that the country's faced. It's the fastest growing crime. It's also the one thing which we're hearing so much about on the news now, and yet people still do not understand what it's like for someone who's to have their life so turned inside out that they would, you know, work as slaves for another person. And that's just bonded labour. If you imagine them taking that, being forced to work in the sex industry as a prostitute for your, you know, young life from, say, 14 through to the end of your worthwhile and useful working age for these people, it's just an incomprehensible horror. And I think that whilst we're hearing more about it in the public media and on telly and on radio shows like this, I think people still find it very difficult to understand what it's all about.
And did your former career as a police officer influence your decision to set up this charity?
Well, of course, that's probably what drove me into this. I mean, I'd seen so many times, I've seen cases of this nature as a police officer, but I'd never really realised that how much of a problem this could be, because in the police you only deal with things like this when they're reported to you. And there's no one actually out there trying to identify the women that have been trafficked, to try and put in preventative mechanisms to stop it from happening and to change the culture of businesses and industries that are actually taken advantage of by traffickers and exploited for their infrastructure so that they can provide a place for these slaves to be really exploited by these evil people.
And how does SAFE help tackle this problem?
Well, it's really difficult. SAFE's quite a small charity, but I mean we recognised that something needed to be done in this regard. So one of the first things that we did is we set up a reporting hotline, and we then were able to embed this hotline into sex industry businesses. And what we wanted to see was whether there was a will within an illegal industry, such as the sex industry, to work with us and to try and prevent people from being trafficked and people who were underage from being exploited. And this works on quite a unique thought, really, that actually this illegal sex industry might be totally against trafficking and totally against underage sexual exploitation, whilst feeling, positively disposed to the sale of sex. And this takes a lot of getting your head around. But actually, we found that most people who were engaged or involved in the sex industry were vehemently opposed to human trafficking and to the sexual exploitation of those who were underage. And this provided us with a real opportunity to work that kind of goodwill from within that industry. We had reports. Those reports we were able to investigate. And those investigations led to rescues.
And I understand you now focus on several key areas. Could you explain those to us, please?
Well, yeah, because obviously this is probably the most difficult part of the whole job, really. We went into an illegal business area, set up systems to prevent human trafficking and underage sexual exploitation, and we were able to do that in an illegal business. But the problem is, it's not just the illegal business. Trafficking occurs in a number of legal areas as well. So if you look at maybe our hotel infrastructure, these can be subverted by very ruthless, evil people, traffickers, and they provide an infrastructure for trafficking. And if it's not checked and prevented, it can go on under the noses of well-intentioned individuals. The same applies, for other areas. I mean, gosh, we all know the problems that occur in other sectors, such as the agricultural sector, where a lot of farm workers are bonded labourers, or people who were killed on Morecambe Beach picking mussels. These people were trafficked, but the sex industry is similarly vulnerable to such hostile takeover by traffickers. And so we then look into areas where the legal sex industry operates, strip clubs and lap dancing bars, and obviously in certain less effectively run places, less professionally run places, women can be trafficked and prostituted in exactly the same way as they are in some of the worst sex industry businesses.
I understand also it affects children's homes.
Well, you're quite right, Angela, and in fact statistics that tell us that something like 70% of people who have gone into a prostitution did so from a background of the care system. I think it tells you that there's something very, very, very wrong with the way that young people who are in care are actually groomed and prepared for a life in service in the sex industry. Now, it's my belief, that this is indicative of internal trafficking within the young people who are underage and the sexual exploitation wholesale of those same young people. And I think there's good grounds for seeing, for that belief, when you see the types of inquiries that are going on across the country as we speak, into the inadequacies of the care system and the way that this has let down young people. One of the things that we're working on is we're trying to create standards that would be able to be applied to the areas where these children's homes exist. Standards that would monitor the way that pedophiles or potential pedophiles were able to try and exploit the opportunities to groom those young people. It's best if I tried an example, really. If you thought of a young person in a children's home, very frustrated, very upset, very alone, very confused. They wander out of their children's home when they've got chance. They see people sat in a car. They can smell, maybe they're smoking marijuana joint. This isn't the first time for them. Perhaps they've done it before. They go over and see if they can have a blast. The next thing, these people are offering them drugs, and it's quite a deliberate attempt by these groomers to get alongside these vulnerable ones and take advantage of them and find ways of exploiting them. And I think that it's understanding the types of things that go on the streets, near to, outside and close to children's homes, I think is the secret to protecting and making them safe.
Is there such a thing as a typical person who is trafficked? Do they come from certain countries? Are they certain age groups?
Well, no, there is no such thing as a typical person. And, I think that the profile is completely varied. I mean, we've experienced a number of young people who are from English backgrounds, girls 14, 15 that have been trafficked. At the same time, we've also come across people who were trafficked from Eastern Europe, 18, 19, that kind of age. And so there's no obvious pattern here. There's no obvious country where people come from. They come from anywhere in the world where they can effectively be taken advantage of. But probably the one thing which is typical here is vulnerability. And what we see so often is that a person has become vulnerable and a trafficker has identified that vulnerability and exploited it. So those vulnerabilities can be around, a relationship that's formed where the vulnerable person believes that the exploiter, the trafficker, cares for them or loves them, you know, maybe gives them gifts, supplies, meets their needs or what they believe their needs are for fun or excitement or for even drugs and stuff like that. And then whilst they're meeting this perceived need, the vulnerable person is drawn further and further into patterns of behaviour which then lead ultimately to the internal trafficking or the actual trafficking of that person and the sexual exploitation of those people as well. So it's about vulnerability, and that can happen in a number of ways. Extreme poverty, or maybe you're out of your depth in a country that you're not familiar with, and you've lost your job and you just don't know where you're going to go and somebody offers to help. So it's always about the vulnerability, and then the person recognizing or knowing that it's there or even creating that vulnerability, being prepared to exploit it to the point where that person is completely, completely destroyed.
So we have vulnerability, but has the free movement of labour had an impact? Is it a case of there are less checks abroad which allow it to go unchecked?
Well, you're right. It's very difficult to say that free movement of people hasn't had some impact. And there are a lot of people trafficked even from within the European Union. And what you find is that people are being brought from parts of the European Union where there are vulnerabilities, and they're brought over because maybe they could be used for illegal marriage scams. And so there are all kinds of ways that people can be trafficked, but it's always about the vulnerability. It's not so much the freedom of movement that's the issue. It's the fact that people will always try and exploit the vulnerable, and they will just find other ways of exploiting them. I mean, you don't need to get past border guards with a vulnerable child from a children's home. You just have to wait until they're eight old enough to leave the children's home and live independently. And if you've exploited them all the way through, then yours, you've got them in some kind of industry that their parents wouldn't have thought was appropriate for them.
And SAFE has actually rescued women from a life of exploitation. And how has being trafficked impacted on their lives?
Oh, it's just unimaginable. It's almost impossible for me to explain, to be honest, Angela. But basically, what happens when somebody is initially trafficked is they're subjected to a series of controls that make them completely dependent upon their trafficker, terrified, in fear, and completely under the control and the spell of their trafficker. So this vulnerability is built upon, maybe they use fear, violence, dependency on substances, maybe they use all of those things, but whatever happens, the result is the same. The person is very, very, very severely damaged psychologically and sometimes physically. And the bottom line is that when you inflict such damage on a person, I would liken it to battlefront terror. These people are subjected to only on a daily basis, 24 hours a day, and these people's lives are broken and crushed. It creates massive post-traumatic stress, and the result of that post-traumatic stress is often dissociation and other kinds of personality disorder that are often associated with extreme trauma. Now, if those are the mechanisms that you've used to control someone so that you can effectively train that person to say that they've not been trafficked and they don't need help, even when they see a police officer because they're terrified of the police, they're terrified of you, they're terrified of everything. If you can train someone and damage them that much, you don't see a recovery quickly. That's where I do take my hat off to the amazing aftercare service providers that are out there. I'm thinking particularly of organisations like the Madai Trust, the Salvation Army, who run the system that takes people that have been trafficked right through to aftercare, the national referral mechanism. They actually manage that for the government, and then other organisations, almost too many to name now, but they do really good work with very damaged individuals, and recovery can. The recovery starts in 6 months.
Okay, thank
years.
You, John. And so how does SAFE help people who have been trafficked?
Well, first of all, if we receive reports, we're able to help people and get them through that first stage and into recovery. But actually, the other way that we're helping is we're creating standards that prevent trafficking and make it impossible for traffickers to exploit the industry infrastructures that they have taken advantage of for so long. So really, support our standards and support our organisation. I mean, we're not maintained through government grant. We're maintained through subscription and through private donation, which is wonderful, from our supporters. One of the ways that people could really help, though, is that we're looking to try now and identify the areas where young people have been vulnerable out in the communities. Those young people who are in care, they've been exploited in parks or in the close proximity to where they've lived, where they should be safe, where they should be feeling safe. And we'd like to hear from anyone in the area who may actually have had experience firsthand of this type of exploitation and this type of process of grooming and abuse, because we'd like to try and create standards that will make our children's homes safe, the areas around our children's homes safe.
And how can people get in touch?
Well, if people are able to make a first contact with us, that would be very helpful. I mean, if you send them an email to admin@safe.uk.net, just telling us your name and how we can contact you, and then we'll touch base after that and have a little word with you about how we can get these ideas up from you and into a working framework where we can actually make a difference, I think, for the most vulnerable of these groups, which is those people who are in care and through the care system, where the risks, I think, of exploitation are the greatest.
And can you give people the website, also the telephone number?
Yeah, our website is www.safe.uk.net, and our phone number is 0844 800 8563, but you may well get through to an answering machine, and if you do, just leave your details.
John Redmond from Standards Against Female Exploitation, SAFE. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Angela.
Just to recap those details, the website is www.safe.uk.net. The telephone number is 0844 800 8563. or you could email admin@safe.org.uk.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, we haven't heard from him for a couple of months, but he's in the studio now. His name's Ed Lander. He is working now with the Open Rights Group, ORG. Hi, Ed Lander. Welcome back to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. It's good to be here.
Now, ORG, you've mentioned them in some of your previous reports from back earlier in the year, sort of May time. What is the Open Rights Group?
The Open Rights Group are one of the UK's leading digital rights and privacy campaign groups.
Why do we need digital rights?
We need digital rights to protect us and to give opportunities for creative people to monetize their work, but also to encourage creativity. It's a bit of a tricky balancing act there.
So the idea being is if you create a program or a bit of software or something, or even a picture, which is digital nowadays, that it's not just simply copied and spread around and people using it ad infinitum without you being credited or paid for it.
Yeah, that's the modern world we're living in, where files can be copied and distributed very easily. But I think it's fair where people choose to protect their intellectual property, that they can monetize it and allow them to continue doing that work. Obviously, some people choose to give their work away for free. I was reading earlier today about a 13-year-old kid who'd created a Lego kit for printing Braille, and he decided to just gift the design and gift the software to the community out of kindness.
But surely the whole point of the internet, the thing that makes it really useful and successful, is the fact that it's very easy freely to share information around.
Yeah, as I said, it's a tricky balancing act, and it's wonderful to share and collaborate and allow people to use each other's work and improve it. But you will see that with private companies, you know, they demand profitability to keep themselves running, and they will choose to protect that work, to protect their portfolio and their business model, really.
Okay, down to earth a bit more, and we've got this new thing called Windows 8. Well, it's not really new. It's very different to the previous versions of Windows. Most people I've spoken to don't like it. Just this week there's an article on ZDNet, that's ZDNet.com, by Steve Ranger. He's saying Windows 8, why Microsoft's giant gamble didn't pay off. Even when it was launched, Windows 8 was seen as a gamble, but one that Microsoft had to make. The stunning out-of-nowhere success of tablets was making the PC look stodgy and out of date. So Microsoft had to show that Windows could still be relevant beyond its traditional desktop home. The company's response was this new Windows 8, with its colourful tiled interface and the emphasis on Windows as a touchscreen operating system. But he's saying, actually, despite many cases of these innovations, the reception to Windows 8 was lukewarm, and it's forced them to deliver a rapid update in the shape of Windows 8.1. So what are your thoughts about all this? And Microsoft's incredibly powerful. I even saw the Bishop of Bristol, Michael Hill, giving a sermon to 500 school children at Colston Boys School, Colston Girls School, and the Withywood Merchants Academy, where he was bigging up Bill Gates, saying what a wonderful man he was, and he'd been very successful, and but he was giving money to charity, and what a wonderful thing that was. Well, it's great giving money to charity, but actually this kind of philanthropy, I think, is also comes with a bit of a political edge. But anyway, what are your thoughts about Windows 8 and why it's had such a bad reception?
I think it's a typically Microsoft response. I think a lot of their business strength was just on monopolizing the market. They got in early with the hardware producers and bundled their software, and they dominated and to some extent bullied out competitors. And finally, when they had a significant competitor in the likes of Apple, they panicked. I've seen interviews with Steve Ballmer trying to make excuses for their new tablet devices and Windows 8 shortcomings, and it was just such an awfully clumsy fudge, where they'd try to overlay some glossy, shiny new features onto a fundamentally still very desktop-centric Windows infrastructure, and it clearly failed. I don't use it. I've worked for companies who've explicitly asked the IT guys to uninstall it and install Windows 7 or alternatives. So it's deeply unpopular because I think it was badly implemented. It was, as with most Microsoft things, just building on layers and layers of poor coding and poor user interfaces.
Yeah, if you go to the touchscreen phones, the smartphones, for example, one of the popular operating systems on there is the Android one. I mean, it is designed for to be a touchscreen system, and it's designed to be, you know, that you obviously don't have the space really with a touchscreen phone for a proper full keyboard, that sort of thing. And so do you think maybe it's just simply that Microsoft are trying to do the impossible here and say that actually you can have an operating system which is fine for a full-size laptop or a desktop machine, which could be the same as something which is for a tiny little a smartphone?
It was a big ask, and I think they tried to solve that problem and they failed. They should have probably just targeted it much more specifically instead of try to tackle both problems and make an awful frustrating and clumsy mess of it.
You know, I've been to a couple of places which sell new computers, and you cannot get anything but Windows 8. I mean, this is the problem, isn't it, with a giant company like Microsoft. As you were saying about the monopoly, there isn't any choice. And if you say, oh, actually, I don't want this, there's another thing is that Windows 7 has some fantastic video making software with it. For example, the Windows Live Movie Maker is bundled in free with Windows 7. Yeah. Nothing like it at all, even from the Windows NT days. You know, you used to get something, but there's nothing in Windows 8 at all. So what can you do if you want to get a new computer but you don't want Windows 8?
I believe a lot of the distributors do offer alternatives. I think if you go to Dell's website, you can choose to install a Linux-based operating system like Ubuntu. So there are alternatives out there, and they're generally free. With regards to Windows Live Movie Maker, I think Microsoft got a lot of flack for anti-competitive practices where they were bundling in all kinds of useful software into Windows, and particularly I think the European courts didn't like it. So bit by bit, piece by piece, they were pulling out these useful utilities, leaving very much a raw operating system, and I imagine that's what we have with Windows 8.
Okay. I think it's also true to say that most people that sell computers, apart from the big people like PC World and Currys, are actually able to put a version of Windows 7 on. But the thing is that they have a kind of Microsoft license and a Microsoft agreement, so that ties them to do that. Mm. It's really annoying, isn't it? That, you know, that actually the consumer is the last person that gets a say in all this. And if you want a new laptop, you're going to have this rubbishy system that doesn't actually have all the features from the previous Windows 7. It's also fair to say that if you go into some of the smaller shops, thing to do as usual is shop around. Yeah. A lot of them will have the ability to install Windows 7. It might cost you an extra 50-60 quid or something to install Windows 7, but there are a lot of people out there. Even if it comes to it, get out the yellow pages, go through there. Yeah. Talk to some computer, particularly people who will repair computers, often have the ability to put this better operating system on, and I don't think there's much doubt that Windows 7 is better. Okay, yeah. Off it, my little bug bit. Oh, you want to say something else
quickly? It's the same hardware underneath, so there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to do that. And I think all this is doing is pushing more and more customers towards Apple, because they're the key alternative, and people are spending more money, but they're so frustrated with Windows 8 that they seem like they're moving in their droves.
Well, another thing to mention is a lot of software which people may have bought for previous versions of Windows, even as far back as Windows 2000, or, you know, stuff which works on those old systems, doesn't work on Windows 8. Mm. It worked on Windows Vista. It worked on, I'm thinking of various bits of software I've got. You stick it into try and make it work on Windows 8, and he goes, no. And then, hang on a minute, I paid whatever it is, 200 quid for that bit of software, and you're just saying you can't use it. So this is an absolute dog's breakfast, this, and I think it's worth you know, mentioning that with a little bit of shopping around, you can actually make your computer, your new computer, work. You don't have to try and work around the horribleness that is Windows 8. Anyway, back to Open Rights Group, Ed.
Yep.
And you've been along to their national conference recently. So what was that all about?
That was where? Brilliant. That was a two-day conference based in central London called OrgCon. The first day was at King's College London. The second day was at the Foundry, which is near Vauxhall Station. It was a case of discussions and panel talks and presentations, a nice collection of medium for people to learn and understand and discuss the problems around privacy, surveillance and digital rights.
Okay, so what was your take home from that? A couple of things that you got from the conference.
Well, I was very impressed with all of it. I think the Open Rights Group have demonstrated that they're a very professional outfit. People seem to have a really good time. I think there's a large community of software engineers in particular who are very much supportive of what they do, and they have disposable income. So I think the Open Rights Group are a force to be reckoned with. I heard that Cory Doctorow's keynote speech was very well received indeed, and I enjoyed all of the events and talks that
but
I had.
But what about practical stuff that's actually able to, you know, has helped you and taught you things from the conference?
There was a session on encryption on day two, which was to try and give people an overview and introduction into how to use it, how to protect your privacy. There were other discussions and presentations all about campaigning, successful campaigns, how to campaign. So I think there were many aspects that people could learn from and take away from the conference. It was very well balanced.
If it's at Vauxhall Station in London, it's very close to MI6, I think, and MI5, just around the corner.
Oh, that's just convenient for them.
So I wonder if they're spying on it, wondering. Anyhow, how do we just follow what ORG and Open Rights Group are up to, and what's on their agenda at the moment?
So they have a website which is up to date with their events, campaigns. There are sister websites that spring off that. They have a Facebook page. They're on Twitter. They've got meetup groups, so you can find out what's going on in your local area. So they're very, very broadly distributing their information.
Well, one of the things I know they've been pushing is this whole thing, Error 451, and it took a little while for the penny to drop with me that this is actually a play on words with Ray Bradbury's book Fahrenheit 451, which was based on the temperature at which paper combusts or spontaneously bursts into flames. So, what is Error 451?
Error 451 is a brilliant idea. I think this is in response to all the censorship that we're beginning to see rolling out across the internet.
Well, on Google, almost every search you do now on Google's got this little thing saying, "Oh, and by the way, we've erased certain results from your search, and we're not going to tell you what they are."
That's typically, I believe, maybe naive, that's typically to do with copyright infringement. I believe there are ways to find out details of that. But
Ed, I have to put you right there, because a lot of it is requests. It's this digital right to be forgotten, where people put in a request to Google centrally to say, "I wish this information about me to be removed from the Google search." And Google are not telling anybody how they are making decisions, but they are, it seems, maybe even arbitrarily saying, "Well, yes, we think that this person's dodgy past should be covered up, and this person shouldn't." So it could be the end for Google, couldn't it? If you're going to use Google to search, or another search engine, surely you're not going to bother with Google, because the rich and powerful have paid to have all the dodgy stuff from their past removed from the Google search.
Yeah, I don't believe it's going to be very helpful to the adoption of their tools. There was discussion at the conference exactly about this idea of individuals and the right to be forgotten and where that will take us. Moving to 451, it's the idea that once you've actually gone to a website or trying to access a website, even if you type in the address manually, you're physically blocked. You're blocked by your internet service provider. At the moment, there are different methods of demonstrating this. You might just got a forbidden message. You might have an explicit message from your ISP saying, "We've blocked this website." But the idea of the 451 campaign is to give you much more information, is to standardize these messages to say, "This website has been blocked, and for these reasons," and the next step is to say, "Here are the court documents supporting this blocking." So it's giving people some information and transparency into why the internet is being shut down in front of our eyes, and that's obviously a very scary thing to witness.
Well, the rich and powerful are doing very well out of the recession, because austerity hasn't affected them. The quantitative easing is pushing up their share prices. Mm. They're doing very nicely out of it, and pension funds and things like that. So obviously they are going to be spending money on lawyers to get Google to take information off. Is this the end of the internet?
I think it's the beginning of a very painful, long and drawn out battle, and I really hope that the community who enjoy the internet, who enjoy its openness, will just continue to put in their time and energy to try and prevent it being undermined. And if to some extent it ever was, as we know it, undermined significantly, I'm pretty sure that alternative networks would spring up, and we might start seeing World Wide Webs that are just a case of a network of ordinary computers bypassing ISPs, bypassing the major server hubs. We just see that's the beauty of the internet, that it's a very disruptive technology, and people always find ways around such censorship.
Well, let's certainly hope so. Just remind us, if people are interested in Open Rights Group in Bristol, where do we go?
Well, you can contact myself. I think the best port of call is to go to meetup.com and find the Open Rights Bristol group on there. You should be able to use a search engine of your choice to find that.
Not necessarily Google.
And yeah, sign up and you will automatically notify you about events in the local area. And of course, you're free to suggest any events that you would like to see happen. And we're obviously more than happy to have everyone come along, get involved, ask questions.
Okay, Edlanda, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Cheers, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Jeff Sparks, what's on this week?
Thank you. This is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 21st of November, The Creep Show will be performing with special guests at The Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 21st of November, The Hide will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Ginger Wildheart. The frontman for the Wildhearts has recently put together a fan club titled Gas. For more information and to sign up, you need to access g-a-s-s.co/main. This is a song from September's releases and is titled The Pendine Incident. One conversation I'll always remember was a place where the weather had forced me to stay. A man with my accent and a face full of stories had caused me to look his way. A few drinks of whiskey had bought me his story. I looked in his eyes as he looked back. Ginger Wildheart with The Pendine Incident from September's edition of Gas. Into Saturday 22nd of November, Soul to Soul featuring Jazzy B and Karen Wheeler will be performing at the Colston Hall in Colston Street, Bristol. Tickets are £26.50 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 23rd of November, Trapped will be performing at The Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guests, that's Nick Outerside and also John Redman from SAFE and Ed Lander from the Open Rights Group here in Bristol, and also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling. Wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
This is Cyan Train, a track from the LP Grow Together on China Records, indeed the title track from that.